Crews continue to make progress on the Lolo Creek fire and to stay on top of some new lightning-caused fires. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and fire tops our news again tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce looks into the controversy over the price of coal leases. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with New York City Assistant Fire Chief Ron Spadafora about responding to the 9/11 attack and about fighting fire in Montana. The Lolo Creek Complex is no longer the number one firefighting priority in the country. That dubious honor goes to California's Rim Fire, the 234-square-mile monster burning near Yosemite National Park. However, that doesn't mean the Lolo Complex fire no longer poses a significant threat. Fire Information Officer Dave Schmidt says operations this weekend focus on the fire's west, south, and east sides. He says those flanks are now fairly well secured with mop-up in progress. Aerial and ground assault continued today on the fire's north side.
Working both from the east and west toward the middle, and they made good progress with line. It was using dozers and hand line and a lot of bucket work with retardants and water, so they're doing well.
There are several important assets north of the Lolo Complex, including a high-voltage BPA power line 1 mile south of Blue Mountain.
Yeah, the power line, as you know, is a major power line for the northwest, supplies a lot of people. That is in the path of the fire. Should it start moving north in a major way, right now it's not doing that. It's kind of, it's moving a little bit, but not significantly on a daily basis. If we get some winds and start the fire moving, and it does start that way, the threat to that power line would come up. We have people up there now who are kind of scouting line locations and possible things that we can do to secure a line should the fire start moving north. We're in communications with BPA about that issue, and we have a person who, if the line is threatened, will come down here and be part of our suppression force in the overhead to advise us on what to do and coordinate our activity with BPA's activity and what they do. So I think we're pretty well connected in for that line should the fire start moving.
The Forest Service's Blue Mountain Lookout is another concern.
And we have made arrangements to wrap the lookout with fire resistant material so that if the fire should move to that area, it would protect the lookout and prevent it from getting burned. And then the recreation area that's there also, we're looking for line that we can protect that area from fire should it start moving north. So we've looked at all three of those issues. We are getting plans in place should they be needed to fight the fire and minimize the damage to those resources.
A small observatory owned by the University of Montana is close to that lookout. The observatory is a 16-inch telescope used primarily for education and outreach events by the University of Montana. It was installed there sometime in the 70s. UM Physics and Astronomy Assistant Research Professor Diane Friend says she's confident it's as safe as it could be given the circumstances.
To lose the observatory because I love doing the open house nights up there, and I think that it served a wonderful purpose all these years. But the fire, the last I knew, was still quite a ways from the observatory. It was about 2.5 miles or so. And there is also, as you probably know, the BPA power line that is south of the observatory, between the observatory and the present location of the fire. And I know they're really concerned about that, so that's something that I assume that they'll be vigorously defending.
At least two firefighters were pulled off the lines this weekend, one for asthma-related respiratory problems, the other for a dislocated shoulder after being struck by a falling snag. Both have since returned to active duty. A scheduled open house in which the public is invited to visit the observatory to look through the telescope will likely be canceled this Friday night due to the fire threat. Friend asks anyone interested in participating to simply Google Blue Mountain Observatory to keep tabs on this year's remaining open houses. A public information meeting on the Lolo Creek Complex fire is scheduled tonight at 8 o'clock at the Lolo Elementary School Lower Gymnasium. The thunderstorms that rolled through west central Montana late yesterday afternoon brought at least 100 lightning strikes to the Missoula and Nine Mile areas. Lolo National Forest spokesman Boyd Hartwig says the Nine Mile Ranger District has responded to 10 new initial attack fires since yesterday.
The most problematic fire was the Nemote Fire, about 4 miles northeast of Tarkio. It went from about a half acre to 10 acres to 20 acres pretty rapidly yesterday. We just got a report that the firefighters have a hand line around it, so that's good news. We had a Type 1 helicopter on it, working it this morning, too. So things look pretty good. We had higher humidities this morning, and that helped as well.
The Brewster Creek Fire, burning 8 miles south of I-90 in the Rock Creek drainage, is about a half acre at last report, but burning in a steep, rugged terrain and not threatening any structures.
Cooler weather continues to keep wildfires in Yellowstone under control, allowing park officials to reopen the mud volcano area north of Fishing Bridge. The mud volcano and other areas along the Yellowstone River have been closed for over a week because of the Alum Fire. Some trails, picnic areas, and road pullouts remain closed today. The Alum Fire has burned about 12 square miles. The fire is only a few hundred yards from the Grand Loop Road, but isn't growing much. Park officials are allowing the fire to burn without interference to help the ecosystem. Meanwhile, they're clearing vegetation northwest of Bridge Bay to protect Billings in case the fire moves that way. Four smaller fires continue to burn slowly in mostly remote areas of Yellowstone.
And in other news from around the state, authorities were searching today for two men reported missing after separately taking their boats out on two western Montana lakes. Nathan Bird, 36, of Houston, left the Paradise Cove campground for Flathead Lake yesterday morning in a 21-foot boat with his two dogs, Lake County Sheriff spokesman Karen Sargent told Kerr Radio. The boat was found adrift about 1.5 hours later with only one of the dogs aboard. The other dog was found wet and shivering on shore, but there was no sign of Bird. Authorities began their search that afternoon and resumed it again this morning. The Missoulian reports that the search became a recovery operation after a helicopter later flew over nearby islands and saw no sign of Bird. A search also was underway for a 69-year-old Great Falls man missing since he took his boat out on Placid Lake on Friday. Delray Samen's boat was spotted on the lake Friday afternoon with nobody inside. The search has included a helicopter and a dive team. Samen's family members say they are hoping his body can be found so they can begin the grieving process. The retired business owner's stepdaughter, Jenny Reeves, said the family is appreciative of the compassion and dedication shown by the search and rescue teams.
Democrat John Lewis has filed paperwork to enter the 2014 race for the Montana U.S. House seat held by Republican Steve Daines. Lewis earlier this month left his job as state director for U.S. Senator Max Baucus. The Billings native is the first to formally file federal paperwork to run for the office. Republican Matt Rosendale has filed paperwork that leaves open the possibility of a House or Senate run. Baucus announced earlier this year he won't be seeking another term, and so far no Democrats have filed to run for that seat. Many expect Daines to vacate his House seat and run for the Senate. If he does, several Republicans have said they would vie to replace him in the House.
The Department of Interior has recently published a report citing some flaws in how the federal government manages coal leases. The June report from the Office of Inspector says the government is at risk of not getting the full value for the coal it sells. The nonprofit environmental group, the Northern Plains Resource Council, believes this is especially true for coal in Montana and Wyoming's Powder River Basin. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
The Northern Plains Resource Council thinks the federal government and the states should be getting a lot more money for Powder River Basin coal.
The state and federal governments have lost billions of dollars, I think, in the process.
That's Mark Squillaci. He's a professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School. Northern Plains brought him to the Capitol building recently to talk to state officials and other interested parties about the subject. Squillaci has been looking into this for years. Here's how he says coal is being undervalued. First, it's in the competition for coal leases. He says companies will apply for small lease tracts right next to a larger plot they are already leasing.
And they design it so it's not big enough to attract a third party from the outside to come in and develop a new standalone mine.
He says they then do this multiple times, giving the companies a lot of freedom in setting their own very low prices. Squillaci and others the Northern Plains Resource Council brought in say the government has other safeguards to ensure fair market value, like regular appraisals before the coal is sold and audits afterward. But they assert the appraisal process is weak and audits are very rarely done. Cloud Peak Energy is one of the coal companies operating in the Powder River Basin. Senior Vice President for Marketing and Government Affairs Jim Orchard says the BLM is under no obligation to take the bids the company offers. He does not believe the company is getting an unfairly low price for Powder River Basin coal. He says if you look at the report from the Office of Inspector General, it says the potential for undervaluing is there, but the report is pretty positive overall.
So I'm a little bit intrigued that people are saying just short number of months after that report has been released that the BLM's not doing a good job.
And Orchard says Cloud Peak just decided not to bid on a Powder River Basin coal tract in Wyoming.
If the coal was undervalued as a sort of generic statement, you would expect, obviously, coal companies to be, you know, lapping up as much as you could.
The domestic market for coal has been declining in recent years as more cheap natural gas is being drilled. Cloud Peak says market conditions and the uncertainty of the current regulatory environment caused the company not to bid. BLM Public Affairs Specialist Kristen Lenhart says the Bureau is following laws laid out in a 58-page manual to determine fair market value for coal. But she says the federal office in Washington, D.C. is continuing to look into the report put out by the Office of Inspector General.
And we are continuing to seek ways to evaluate the process while sticking to our existing regulations, laws, and policies.
Whether that means the BLM will charge more for coal remains to be seen. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Governor Steve Bullock has named a panel to look into Montana's gender gap in pay. Bullock signed an order in June creating the Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force to be headed by Labor Commissioner Pam Busey and Department of Administration Director Sheila Hogan. Today, he filed out the rest of the panel. They included Montana State University President Waded Cruzado, Women's Foundation of Montana Program Director Jen Ewell, and Missoula College Dean Barry Good. Rounding it out are our union leaders, Jackie Helt and Kim Rickard, Interior Environments Incorporated owner Deb Larson, Salish Kootenai College Laboratory Manager Amy Stiffarm, and CTA President Scott Wilson. The panel will gather information and provide recommendations on policies and other actions.
A Yellowstone County official is accused of plagiarizing an anti-President Barack Obama letter to the editor. Conservative writer Michael Massey says a letter to the editor by Yellowstone treasurer, assessor, and school superintendent Max Lendington copied Massey's syndicated column. The Billings Gazette reports the letter ran in the newspaper yesterday and last week in the Casper Star Tribune. The letter is titled "Why I Hate Barack and Michelle Obama," and it contains slightly revised passages that otherwise is a condensed version of Massey's editorial, "Why I Do Not Like the Obamas." Massey says what Lennington did was dishonest. Lennington did not respond to messages or answer his door yesterday. Lennington previously asked Massey's permission to use his comments. Massey said he could if they were attributed and unchanged. They weren't.
Firefighters from around the country are helping fight the Lolo Creek Complex fire west of Lolo, and some, like New York City Assistant Fire Chief Ron Spadafora, are there to learn more about how fires are fought in the West. The 59-year-old Spadafora is a 35-year veteran of the New York City Fire Department, having risen from the ranks to become the department's chief of logistics. Spadafora was one of the first responders on the scene on 9/11 and personally knew many of the firefighters who lost their lives trying to save others. News Director Sally Mock spoke with Spadafora just before he left Montana to return to New York about that fateful day on September 11th, 2001. He says he was at home when he got the call to come to work.
I arrived on the scene and the North Tower had just collapsed. We were trying to organize our troops. We were also, I was involved with World Trade Center 7, which came down a couple of hours later in the evening around 5:30. It was a 47-story building. A lot of people don't even know that that building also collapsed. I was in that building providing recon for our units to determine whether we wanted to commit to try to put out the fire. Decision was made after the return of the chief, so we're evaluating that building not to go in there. In hindsight, it saved a lot more firefighters from being killed.
You were told to evacuate at some point from that building.
Yes, we after we did our reconnaissance of the building, came back to the branch chief who was in charge of that area. We gave that chief information stating that too much fire, and we felt that not everyone had a radio. Firefighters were coming in from home. A lot of firefighters didn't have the proper equipment to fight that fire, so we decided that we were going to evacuate the building.
Hard lessons learned that day, weren't there?
Definitely. We reached out to McKinsey and Company after the fire was in the recovery stage. We had them do an analysis of our department in regards to what were some of our shortcomings. And one of the things that they, after the study came out, They were with us for a few months, asking us questions about where we were at during the fire, what were some of our problems in regards to communications, organization, things like that. One of the things that they recommended was for we told them about the Southwest team with the incident management team coming in and meeting us and asking us if they could help in any way. A little funny story is with a chief officer who was looking at the Forest Service personnel, and he kind of said, "Where are you guys from?" And they said, "Well, we're from the Forest Service." So he said, he looked at their patch and he said, "What, you see any trees around here? How can you help us?" And the guy goes, "Well, we have something called Incident Command System, and we have we can develop an incident action plan and have you focus in on what your objectives are, and also that plan will help you allocate your resources, look at where you are at one moment in time, how you're progressing to meet your objectives each day." So the chief said, "All right, we'll give you a chance." He put him up in one of our firehouses. They followed us around for a few days. And then on September 17th, they came up with the first incident action plan that we ever used.
And have been using since.
Yes, and we used it throughout the 9 months of the operation. And then we've been using it since. Yeah, we use ICS for... we use the terminology, and we use ICS for firefighting, emergencies, special events, parades.
I think over 350 New York firefighters died that day, right?
343.
343. You knew half of them, you said.
Yes, that's correct.
And you knew the day that the towers came down that some of them were in there. You had to know that while you were still working.
I tell you, there was no definitive information in regards to exactly who was killed and who wasn't. And you had too many other things to be dealing with in order to try to identify names and things of that nature.
Had like to do
I
your
said,
job.
I came in from home, so it wasn't like I had a crew. As a deputy chief at the time, I came in from home. I was given an assignment in regards to reconnaissance of World Trade Center 7, in regards to extinguishing the fire when 7 came down, in regards to trying to recover. We had a few survivors from the collapse that we were working to extricate from the rubble. So I was a little busy to try to, in regards to trying to define who exactly was killed and what we had no idea the first day or two in regards to the numbers, how many were killed.
You've gone to a lot of funerals, I'm sure.
I went to a lot of funerals, but one thing that I stayed at the World Trade Center the entire 9 months, and I was a site safety officer down there for 8 months. So I was working down there 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and it didn't allow me to attend as many funerals as I could have. And I felt that, you know, it was a little sad trying to, you know, go into funerals. So I felt that doing the work and trying to provide recovery for those people who, both civilians as well as uniformed personnel, trying to recover any type of remains for those families was a way that I could give back.
How did that day, besides the grief that everyone in your department feels, how did that day, do you think, change you personally and change those that you work with now?
Well, in regards to me, I after that day, I always had doubts whether I wanted to be an FBI agent. I could have been a lot of different things in regards to who I am and what type of occupation I wanted to settle into. After that day, I was very happy that I settled on being in the fire service. I felt like I made more of a commitment to the fire service and helping the public. And I was just proud to be in the fire service. The guys gave the ultimate sacrifice, and it just showed the nature of firefighters in general, not just FDNY, but it's all about giving. It's all about service and not really thinking about heroics or personal issues. It's basically about serving the public. So I was very proud of my profession moving forward.
As are we all.
Yes, that's correct.
And now here you are in Montana, and you've been in Montana before, and you were telling me you first came out to Montana on a fire in the Robert Fire in Glacier National Park a few years ago, and that you'd never camped out before that fire.
I never seen so many trees put in close proximity to each other, being living in New York all my life. And I'm not a camping person, fishing person, hunting person. So it was completely different than anything I've ever seen. Like I said, camping out, I never did that before. So I had people from the Alaska team who were up there show me how to pitch the tent. And then they started talking about bears and rattlesnakes. So I was a little nervous at first in regards to what I was getting into.
But now you're an old Montana camper, aren't you? Old Montana hand here.
Well, I've been here in Montana three times. I gave a presentation on 9/11 safety operations to the Montana Fire Chiefs Association. So I was asked to do a presentation. So that was the first. That was another time I came out, and I got to see beautiful Flathead Lake and Paulson. And so I seen the northern part. This is the first time that I've been in the Southwest. I was down south, about 30 miles south of Venice, for the Eureka Fire with Tom Heintz, and that was pretty interesting. It was similar to this type fire, where fire was spreading towards the community, and they were developing a management plan for evacuation, and similar to what's going on here.
Mr. Spadafore, we are so honored to have you here on our fire and so appreciative of you coming all the way from New York to help us out. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for allowing me to talk to you, and thank you all for your hospitality, and I'm just glad to be here.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight look for partly cloudy skies with scattered showers and thunderstorms and areas of smoke. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with areas of smoke. Highs will stay in the mid-80s to lower 90s. For central Montana, tonight expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms through the night. Lows will stay between 50 to 60 degrees with wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour in the evening. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs between 85 to 90 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight look for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will stay around 45 to 55 degrees. Expect south winds around 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will stay around 80 to 90 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Young people graduating from high school face a conundrum. Going to college has gotten more and more expensive, while the economic payoff from having a college degree has increased in value. College tuition and fees have continued to grow much faster than most other costs in the economy. At the same time, state legislators have become increasingly reluctant to subsidize college operations. As a result, more and more of the burden of that growing cost of a college education has shifted to the families of college students, and as they have been tapped out, onto the college students themselves as they take on more and more student loans. This represents a relatively dramatic change in public higher education policy in the United States. In the middle of the 19th century, federal and state governments recognized the increased importance of educating a much broader group of young Americans to apply rapidly developing science to a more and more industrialized economy built around rapid technological change. The result of that federal and state partnership was the establishment of public land-grant colleges. By the early 20th century, almost every state had a public college system. Following the end of the Second World War, the GI Bill expanded federal support for public colleges and universities still further, offering demobilized soldiers broad support to attend college. States expanded their college systems, many of them promising zero tuition to residents who graduated from high school. Not surprisingly, the fraction of young people attending college steadily rose. By the late 20th century, increasing numbers of older adults, non-traditional students, also enrolled in college to enhance their employment and earning potentials. With college attendance rising faster than the economy was expanding, the public cost of expanding the college system and subsidizing all those new students rose. Something else happened, too. Middle-class students from suburbia, and no doubt their families, too, were not satisfied with students living like medieval nuns and monks. They expected modern housing, attractive food, recreational opportunities, etc. competition among colleges to attract students with the living amenities that middle-class students took for granted drove college costs ever upward. The rising bill for this rapidly expanding college system had to be paid by someone. Ultimately, more and more of it settled on students themselves in the form of increasingly problematic debt burdens with which they had to start their adult lives. Some saw this as a reasonable outcome. After all, these students would ultimately reap the benefits of that college education. That is, there was a clear private benefit to the students. Why should they not pay for it? So by default, the solution to the rising cost of higher education offered to students and their families was government-subsidized loans. At the federal and state level, a variety of college student loan programs were set up. Almost anyone could borrow to go to college. Not surprisingly, the pool of subsidized and government-guaranteed loans caught the attention of both colleges and lenders. Entrepreneurs began setting up for-profit schools whose students would qualify for those loans. Those college businesses advertised extensively, promising lots, but delivering little more than dropouts with high debt loads. Established state and private colleges also promoted borrowing in the place of state subsidies and scholarships. With government loans readily available to help cover students' costs, the colleges did not have to worry all that much about constantly hiking tuition. The steady deterioration of well-paid, unionized blue-collar jobs in the last quarter of the 20th century systematically eliminated that blue-collar path to a middle-class lifestyle. Employment opportunities for those with only a high school diploma grew increasingly bleak. More education was trumpeted as almost the only path to a decently paying job. So there has been no shortage of young people and older people who ran into economic dead ends, seriously contemplating going to college, even if it meant taking on considerable debt. What was the alternative? All of the hype about the importance of and payoff from a college education and the marketing of loans by colleges, lending institutions, and government agencies convinced many young people with little financial experience to take on enough debt to threaten rather than enhance their financial futures. Where do we go from here? That was partially what President Obama's speech last week at the University of Buffalo was all about. It is also what is pushing states like Oregon and Washington, as well as the federal government, to suggest replacing student loans with a contract that commits students to pay between 1.5% to 3% of their income over the 24 years after leaving college. The repayments would go back into a college support program for the next generation. Those who do very well after college would more than pay back the cost of their education. Those who have difficulty in the labor market or choose to work for low-pay nonprofits might pay much less than the cost of their education. It would be a progressive way of distributing the cost of a college education across the whole pool of previous students. That would partly reflect the stake the whole society has in a better educated population, as well as reflect the fact that there is a private personal benefit to most people from their college education. Just as importantly, it would not horribly burden young people at the beginning of their adult lives. It is not a solution to the problem of financing a college education, but it is an improvement over the dead end into which the public higher education policies of the recent past have driven us.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.